Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Journalism is a field that depends on trust, and when journalists violate that trust, that makes headlines. Lara Logan of CBS is learning that as a result of a recent bogus 60 Minutes story. Washington Post reporter Janet Cook sullied her and her paper's reputation a generation ago when it was revealed her Pulitzer Prize-winning story was fabricated. More recently, Jason Blair resigned from the New York Times when it was learned he routinely made up and plagiarized stories a decade ago.
I lied and I lied and I lied. I lied about where I had been. I lied about where I had found information. I lied about how I wrote the story. And these were no normal lies. They were lies with details.
Blair's rise and fall is detailed in a film to be shown here this weekend as part of the St. Louis International Film Festival. It's titled A Fragile Trust. Joining me to talk about the film is its producer-director, Samantha Grant. She joins us by phone. Also with us is Matthew Carlson, Associate Professor of Communication at St. Louis University. He is the author of On the Condition of Anonymity, Unnamed Sources, and the Battle for Journalism. Thank you both so much for being with us. Samantha, we look forward to seeing you this weekend when your film is shown. We'll talk more about that a little bit later. But let me begin with you and ask why you decided to take on this particular story. To some people, it might seem like old news.
Right. So I first heard about the Jason Blair scandal when it was happening, like everybody else. It was all over the mainstream media. And then subsequent to that, I went to study journalism at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. And while I was there, we were studying sort of cases that were examples of ethical lapses in journalism as part of the law and ethics curriculum. And when I came upon this story, I just still had a few questions. Despite all the coverage, I felt like exactly what had gone down was not totally clear to me. And I was also at the time working on pitching a thesis documentary for my graduation, and this just seemed like a great subject to explore.
Why is this an important story, do you think, for the public to understand?
Well, I think despite the fact that there was a lot of coverage about the scandal at the time, I think that there was a lot of misunderstandings in terms of using this story as an example of everything that's gone wrong with journalism. One of the things that I really wanted to do in the film is illuminate the fact that this is not a standard case of plagiarism and fabrication, that in fact, this was a very unique set of circumstances that had to come together to allow this type of plagiarism and fabrication to happen, and that this should never be used as an example of really anything other than this specific case of plagiarism and fabrication.
How would you relate it to the Janet Cook affair of some 20 years, I guess it was, earlier?
So the Janet Cook affair, interestingly enough, you know, I knew about that. I learned about that as well in the same class. And I thought, wow, why has no one made a film about this? So I started exploring that originally. And that film, it turns out Columbia TriStar Pictures bought the life rights to that story many years ago, but they have yet to turn it into a screenplay. So that was sort of off the table for me. As far as the similarities between the two, I think in many ways the Jason Blair scandal is complicated by the fact that he also was later diagnosed with mental illness and he was abusing drugs. And there were just a lot of other factors. He was younger that made the story a bit more complicated than the Janet Cook story, which is also, you know, an egregious case of plagiarism or fabrication, as it may be.
Let me turn it to Matt Carlson now. Matt, I'm going to backtrack and ask you the same question I asked Samantha. Why is it important for the public to understand this story from your perspective?
Well, I think that it's a good point to say that this is really something really unique. I mean, if you look at the film, it really chronicles all these things that happened that are just mind-boggling how this happened. At the same time, Jason Blair still reappears. It's 10 years on, and this is still a relevant topic because he gets invoked all the time whenever we have issues of ethical lapses, you'll see the mention of Jason Blair or even the mention of Janet Cook. These people, they're brought back to life again and again and again to make sense of new incidents, even if the new incident isn't anything near it. If you look at the coverage of the News of the World scandal that happened in Britain, and it's still happening, you'll see mentions of Jason Blair. There's no connection with Jason Blair. It's a completely different set of ethical lapses. So in some sense, these people are symbols. They're symbols of journalistic deviance, and they keep reappearing and they keep coming out again to be used to talk about new cases. So I think it's important to sort of see how historically they continue to reappear in our culture.
Yeah, these stories do reappear. I mentioned Lara Logan in the introduction. I guess that's the most recent case of a journalist having a tough time with the facts.
And we make sense of these new incidents by looking at past ones. So Dan Rather in the 60 Minutes story about George Bush's Texas National Air Guard service, that's going to come out again because there's some similarities there, but there's lots and lots of differences. And so we need the past. We need to look at these past incidents to understand what's happening now, even if it's not a good fit.
So, Samantha, I guess a good question that could be asked is, if these instances still continue to this day, what did we learn from the Jason Blair case or Janet Cook, for that matter?
Well, I think it certainly came out that plagiarism doesn't work. Fabrication doesn't work. You will eventually be caught. However, these days, with the speed of technology, people get found out much more quickly than they did, in the time when Jason Blair was doing this. So in terms of what have we learned, I hope that the lesson has been learned that speed is not always the best choice, that speed can lead to faulty judgment. Speed and pressure can lead to faulty judgment. But, I just feel very strongly that all of journalism cannot be judged by the bad behavior of a few people. And I think that that is something that happens, and that's something we need to be really careful about.
I suspect we'll be hearing from some of our listeners during the course of this broadcast with regard to how they feel about the press and the media, if you will, and how trustworthy they believe journalism and journalists are today. I'd like to begin our discussion about your video with a clip from Macarena Hernandez. We'll play the clip, and that'll explain who she is, and there's a certain irony with her involvement in this. Let's hear from Macarena Hernandez.
The only thing you have as a journalist is trust. And it's amazing how people give it to you so freely. I am always amazed when I knock at people's doors, complete strangers, and they'll open their doors and they'll sit me down in their living rooms and they'll pour their hearts out. But it's a very fragile trust. And that's why it's so easy to lose it.
Macarena Hernandez. Samantha Grant, let me ask you to tell her role in this story, because that's where it all starts in your video.
Right. So when we meet Macarena in the film, she appears to be, just another reporter who's working on a story about a soldier who was missing in action during the first Iraq War. And she's talking about how she told the story and what she decided to feature in her telling. And then we hear Jason Blair talking about writing a story of the same subject and how he's going to go through and check the work of other people who've done previous work on this particular subject. And as we go through the film, we discover that the story that Jason Blair published in the New York Times, which happened about 7 days or 5 days after Macarena published her story in the San Antonio Express News, that the Blair story is listed virtually word for word and reprinted with no attribution on the front page of the Times. So that's sort of our first introduction to Macarena. And what we learn as we go through the film and we sort of figure out people's roles in the story is that the supreme irony is that Jason and Macarena knew each other before this even happened. They had been interns together at the New York Times and had spent some time working side by side as up-and-coming kind of star journalists.
Yeah, it's important to note that both of these people were very talented, obviously. You don't get those internships at the New York Times without having a large degree of talent.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, that's one of the things that I really try to show in the film is that Jason he had a great resume. He seemed to be very hardworking. He was, you know, sort of admired by the people who were reading his copy. He was writing a lot of material. But there were also some undercurrents and other signs and things that, you know, people seem to have missed. But it's hard to know if that's the process of evaluation or if that's just because Jason was such an excellent deceiver. It's hard to know. He was pretty good at deceiving when he didn't want stuff to be known.
What were some of those other signs?
Well, he had run into problems at the Globe previously, and the people that he had been working with, you know, if you speak to the other people who had been working with Jason, they have some complaints about his general attitude towards the people that he was working with. Lena Williams in the film, you know, says she brings up the point that some people said he was brown-nosing, that he would come in and he would immediately be very chummy with all the higher-ups at the paper. And that sort of seemed to annoy his cohort, so the other interns, the people that were at his sort of lower level. But Lena and the people at the upper levels said, look, you know, that's what we expected. We would expect that if someone's coming in at a lower level in the Times or any big organization, that they're going to work hard to make themselves useful, to get integrated, to figure out how they can help and, you know, get hired eventually.
Yes, you would expect that people in that particular role, internships and looking to really hit the big time, I suppose, would be ambitious and would find ways to make sure that people recognize that ambition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have to take a break. You've been listening to Samantha Grant, the producer-director of the film A Fragile Trust, which is going to be playing here on Saturday. That'll be at 1:30 at the Plaza Frontenac Cinema. She joins us by phone. With me in studio is Matt Carlson. He teaches communications at St. Louis University and is the author of On the Condition of Anonymity, Unnamed Sources in the Battle for Journalism. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Samantha Grant, producer-director of the film A Fragile Trust, which is playing here this weekend. She joins us by phone. Matthew Carlson teaches communications at St. Louis University. And we are talking about the film A Fragile Trust, which is about Jason Blair, who was a reporter for the New York Times. And a decade ago, he wrote a couple of dozen stories that were fabricated to a very large degree or plagiarized or both. Samantha, let's pick it up almost where we left off, and that is that once Jason Blair wrote this story from the Texas paper that was written by Macarena Hernandez, he was really off and running. I guess he found out that this was a pretty easy way to report.
Well, I don't know that I would say it's that simple. I think, you know, if you take a look at his story and you take a look at the stories of the people around him, he claims that he was really falling apart at the time and that this wasn't his choice. Now, he also acknowledges that he did make some very bad choices. And what I mean to say when he said that it wasn't his choice, he was saying he wasn't of right mind, he wasn't of sound mind, that he was suffering from bipolar disorder, and that was clouding his judgment and making it impossible for him to leave his apartment. I suppose we'll never know whether that's true or not. You know, that's what he said. And as a result of that, he decided that the best way to do the reporting was to just steal from other stories, lift things from here, lift things from there, and make up stuff to fill in the gaps. Honestly, it seems to me that the work he was doing was actually more work than just going and doing the reporting as it was supposed to be done. But, you know, for some reason, he felt that this was his only option.
Yes, that point was well made in the film. I mean, it did take an awful lot of work to do what, in fact, he was doing. Matt, let me bring you into this. Going back to the Macarena story, and then we'll certainly move on. He never did go to Texas. He just took her story. And as is evidenced in the film with other stories that he was involved in, he basically didn't leave his apartment. He was doing it all from other newspapers and other sources.
Yeah, and this is something that we see a lot of now where journalists are very busy and getting out of the office is hard to do. You use your phone, you use your computer. I'm thinking even now with Google Street View, you can write the description of what a house looks like without even having to see it. But I there's something in the film that's very interesting from an ethical perspective in a more mundane way than Jason Blair, which is what they call a toe touch, the New York Times, where you are writing a story in a location. You do most of the work in the newsroom in New York. You get on a plane. You fly to the location. You file your story there, and you fly back to New York. It allows you to have the dateline. It looks like you were there, and that lends some credence, some legitimacy to having been there, of looking like you were on the ground. But is this really reporting on the ground? Is this really getting a sense of what happened? And so this was going on elsewhere at the Times, and I think the idea of a no-touch with Jason Blair of not going at all, of course, seriously crosses the line. But you hear of time and time when journalists are caught, say, reporting on a basketball game they never went to and these kinds of events. So I think there's some more mundane ethical quandaries here about how much time you have to spend somewhere. I mean, no time obviously isn't very good, but how much time is enough time?
You know, it reminds me of a story that, going back well before Janet Cook. An acquaintance of mine named Wells Hangen, who was an NBC correspondent, and he was a correspondent in the then Soviet Union. And he was fired. He ultimately worked for the New York Times as well. Ultimately fired because he wrote a story in Moscow and put on the dateline Leningrad, and he hadn't been there. And when they determined that, he was fired. He was let go. That was the New York Times in the 60s, Samantha.
Well, when, you know, there was a lot of discussion and debate about whether to include the toe touch piece of things, because as I understand it, that's not something that's permitted anymore. Again, I don't work at the New York Times, so I don't know, but I've been told that that's not something that's done anymore and that it was something that was done. And the reason that it is in the film is because Jason uses that as an example of some things that were happening that he saw and thought to himself, huh, well, that doesn't seem like a far leap for me to go from just getting on a plane and touching my toe down on the ground to getting home to just not going at all. You know, I would argue that there is a difference there. It's a subtle difference, but I think, you know, that is crossing the line.
Yeah, I think most people would probably agree with you. I'm going to invite our listeners into this conversation at 382-8255 because I'm very curious about what the response to them will be with regard to trusting the media these days. Lots more to talk about with regard to the Jason Blair stories, but we already have a call from Ronald in St. Louis. Let's see if he advances this conversation, as I suspect he might. Go ahead, Ronald.
Yes, I was calling mainly because I've seen the movie Shattered Glass about Stephen Glass, who did the same thing in the late 70s, and people act like this has never happened before. And as a person who's been directly familiar with stories that were written, and primarily like the Post-Dispatch, I knew that the writers made up most of the details to make the story more exciting. You know, they kind of skirted the truth to make it seem more sensational. But I think the movie Shattered Glass is much more a story about the corruption in journalism that should have been dealt with a long time ago.
Ronald, thanks for the call. Matt, are you familiar with that film and that story?
Yeah, Shattered Glass is another excellent film. It's a fictional film for thinking about journalism, but there's some similarities there in terms of trying to understand sort of the inner workings of a person who's doing this and going through this. And, you know, one thing it makes me think of, Jason Blair or Shattered Glass, is this idea of Why, as the caller says, why sources, the people who are being quoted, don't call attention to these things? I mean, and that comes out in the Fragile Trust documentary when they start calling around and asking people, and they say, I never spoke to this guy. But this happens a lot, where people are either misquoted or their quote is they feel is made up, and there's really not a recourse for it. You know, you feel like you've been misquoted. What are you going to do? Start your own newspaper. You can write a letter to the editor. You can complain. But a lot of time we're at the mercy of journalists in doing this. And I think this is another issue, though, the idea of making up sources that – or sorry, making up statements that happens in small ways in a lot of different newsrooms, not to the extent with Jason Blair or Stephen Glass, but it does happen. So I think that it connects to and I think this is another way Jason Blair connects to wider issues.
Do you want to weigh in on that, Samantha?
Yeah. One thing I really want to emphasize with regard to the film is that when I was deciding whether to make this documentary, I really had to think long and hard about whether I wanted to dredge up, you know, this event that really did tarnish the reputation not only of the Times, but really of journalists everywhere. And I decided that the benefits of getting a conversation started around these issues and also showing that this is not an example of 99.9% of journalists out there working, sort of dispelling those notions, was worth it. I also just really want to emphasize that the vast majority of journalists out there are not doing any of these things. They get up every day and they bust their butts to bring, you know, their version of the facts to the public. It's not a job that people take on because they make a lot of money. It's not a job that people take on because it's very glamorous. It's often a job that people do because it's a calling and they feel they have to do it and they want to, you know, shine a light on dark places and bring some degree of information to the public. It's like a public service job. So I just want to be really careful about using this film as an example to talk about other bad things that other journalists are doing, because I really believe very strongly that the vast majority of journalists out there are working very hard and are working very ethically to deliver news in a timely and accurate fashion.
You indicated earlier that the conditions under which Jason was operating, you know, had various health problems, mental issues, and what have you. Why do you think the management at the Times did not pick up on this more quickly?
So what happened was that Jason turned himself in for drug abuse. And as soon as that happens, portions of his file, due to health privacy laws, become invisible to other managers. And this is something that would happen in any big corporation. So because of health privacy laws, as Jason was moving from one department to the next, the managers could not really discuss among themselves, you know, hey, this guy might be a little unstable. He's had drug problems. You know, he's in counseling, all this type of thing. So I think that really played into the fact that a lot of the management's hands were tied in terms of communicating with one another about Jason.
Did they have to communicate with one another? I mean, there were some pretty high-profile people that were involved in all of this that I think I would suspect could have acted on their own.
So I think because of what was going on at the Times at this period in history, which was really following 9/11, so a couple of things happened at that moment. Number one, a new executive editor and managing editor took over the paper 5 days prior to September 11th. So there was new management in place. And then number two, arguably the biggest news story, you know, of our time happened in the hometown of the New York Times at this moment, and things became incredibly chaotic. So you know, when I was asking someone at the Times about this, you know, why wasn't there more reporting about this? Why wasn't there more exploration of these complaints that were coming up about Jason? He described it as being akin to an environment in an emergency room where you say to the doctor, look, I need more post-operative information on this patient after you do the surgery. And he says, okay, fine. I'll spend my time writing that report, and three other patients are going to die while I'm doing that. So you can either ask me to spend my time doing my job, or you can ask me to spend my time evaluating things that are going on inside the organization. And I think there was just a real, everybody was just working so hard that there wasn't time to be doing this kind of analysis and exploration. And some things did slip through the cracks, and this is an example of that.
Well, speaking of 9/11, I have another clip here. This is of Jason Blair. I'll just set it up by saying that there were a series of profiles of victims that the Times was doing at that particular time following 9/11, and he didn't feel that he had the heart or the emotional wherewithal to deal with writing these kinds of stories. So he decided to write one of his own making, and here's comments about that.
My mother called to inform me that a family friend had died in a plane that hit the Pentagon. I concocted a story about one of my cousins being among the victims so I would not have to write the portraits of grief. I needed something to lift me out of the sadness of a story that I neither wanted to cover nor a world that I wanted to live in. I just wanted to be left alone to disappear into my world of drugging and drinking.
Jason Blair talking about his approach to writing some of the stories that followed 9/11. Matt, do you want to weigh in on what we've been dealing with so far?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about one of the things that happened when Hal Raines took over. We have 9/11, but
that's the managing editor that Samantha was talking about.
Right. Well, he became the executive editor. Hal Raines became the executive editor, so the head of the Times, the head of the news gathering.
Right.
So he's the one calling the shots, and he was known as being dictatorial, I think. I don't know if he would agree with that, but that's what a lot of the journalists accused him of. But something else is going on in the New York Times at this time, too, that comes out later on, which is the reporting, the lead up to the Iraq War, and specifically the reporting of Judith Miller, which would later on become its own journalism scandal. And in my mind, a much worse scandal in terms of actual impact. Jason Blair is interesting for so many reasons. But Judith Miller and her reporting about the intelligence before the Iraq War helped drive public opinion based on bad evidence and some bad, what I would consider bad reporting practices. And part of the way she got away with this is that she didn't have a lot of supervision. There was so much going on in the Times. Jason Blair was taking up some of the attention. There was not a lot of leadership at the time. And it allowed for these other things to happen, too.
Samantha, one of the things that I was curious about with regard to your film is the access that you had to Jason Blair, to the executive editor just mentioned, and others who were involved in all of this who didn't come out of it very well. I'm a little surprised that they wanted to talk about it. Were you?
Yes, it took a long time. You know, working on this film, I started it in 2006, and it's just finishing now. So it did take an exceedingly long time. You know, obviously, it's not the only thing I've been working on, but I've been working on it, and part of the reason that it took so long is that it takes a long time to convince people that it's worthwhile to tell their side of the story when you're doing a film about something like this. And the truth is, you can make a film like this without direct participation of the people involved, simply because there's so much archival material to draw on. But it's far better when you have the time to really sit down and get the firsthand account, and especially the firsthand account with some time to reflect on what's happened, which is what I was able to secure. And as I say, it took ages.
Yeah, but they reflected in a very measured way, I thought. I mean, I thought that was really excellent, their approach to dealing with you and dealing with this issue. One of the key players in all of this was a gentleman by the name of Gerald Boyd. And there are many people in St. Louis who remember Gerald when he was here with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Samantha, tell us about his role as you saw it. And you, before we went on the air, you said he is one of the real, truly tragic cases in this whole story.
Right. So Gerald Boyd, excuse me, was the managing editor at the time that all of this went down. So essentially what happened is Howell Raines was appointed to be the executive editor, and the executive editor gets to choose his managing editor, and Howell chose Gerald. So together, Howell and Gerald had their methods of running the paper, steering this huge ship through these very stormy post-9/11 seas, and because of their management style, they really kind of provoked some ire from the staff. And as a result of that, there was a lot of grumbling and there were a lot of complaints. So that was sort of the scene, the background scene that was happening at the time. Then you have this huge scandal breaking, the Jason Blair journalism scandal. And immediately people hang on to this and use this as an example of why this management style is sinking the ship. That, you know, this management style has been irresponsible, it's been autocratic, people have not been listening to their staff, and as a result, the boat crashed and is sinking now. So that's sort of what happened to both Gerald and Howell. But the piece that was really problematic is that there was some reporting that suggested that Gerald Boyd had personally mentored Jason Blair. And that is problematic for a number of reasons. Number one, it's problematic because it's not true. I spoke with a lot of people about this issue. I interviewed Gerald Boyd's widow about this, and she said that that was by far the most heartbreaking piece of all of this. For Gerald, was that he was aligned with Jason Blair in the reporting of the scandal. And, you know, it would be easy to say that part of the reason that relationship was drawn is that both Jason Blair and Gerald Boyd are African American, and that perhaps someone who was reporting on the story thought, oh, well, if you have this really high-up African-American managing editor, then he must have been personally mentoring Jason Blair because they're two African-American men in a primarily white institution. And the truth is, as far as I can gather, that was not the case at all. And there are a number of people that have said that. Gerald Boyd vehemently denied that he was Jason Blair's mentor. Jason Blair denied that Gerald Boyd was his mentor, and yet still somehow it was reported that Gerald Boyd was his mentor. And I think that really just went to a question of character, which was devastating for Gerald Boyd because he was a very upstanding, very honest journalist.
I have to take another break. I want to pick up on a couple of points that you've made to Samantha and bring Matt back into the discussion. But I do have to take that break. Again, we are welcoming a conversation to be including members of our listening audience. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on air. Back to continue our conversation with Samantha Grant and Matt Carlson. We're talking about the film A Fragile Trust, which deals with Jason Blair and the fact that he fabricated stories for the New York Times a decade ago. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back to our conversation about Jason Blair and the New York Times of a decade ago. Samantha, I'm coming back to you with regard to the racial overtones to this story, if I may put it that way. A lot of people think, and you were talking about Gerald Boyd a moment ago, a lot of people think that because he was black, that Jason Blair was discriminated against somehow. Set the record straight on that.
So after talking to most of the major players that were involved in the scandal at the time, you know, Howell Raines himself says, look, I don't believe that there was any special treatment for Jason Blair because he was black. Essentially, he was part of this reporting program, this training program, and once someone has entered into that program, the folks at the Times are reluctant to flush anybody out of that program. They've been selected, they've been trained, they've been groomed, and they're going to try and work hard with them to keep them in the program. That was number one. Number two is that really the reason that Jason Blair was able to get away with what he was doing for so long had everything to do with a communication breakdown inside the paper. And it wouldn't have mattered whether his skin was black, white, pink, yellow, or green. There was a broken communication system happening inside the paper at that time, and it was a result of that system, not a result of favoritism or discrimination, that allowed him to get away with this for so long. Much more problematic, I believe, is the fact that the story was reported that way in the mainstream media, that the mainstream media took this scandal, took this story, and made it a story about race. And, you know, Lena Williams, who's one of the reporters in the film, says it became about race because a black person was involved. A black person cannot be involved in anything without it becoming about race. And, you know, we look at some of the coverage of the scandal at the time, and, you know, people definitely are bringing up race and focusing on it and mentioning it. And it's hard to know where that came from, if that was just sort of the easy conclusion to jump to, an assumption that was made, an incorrect assumption. You know, Jason Blair definitely did discuss race immediately following the scandal when he was interviewed about it. But subsequent to that and in this film, he says that that wasn't, that did not play a role. That's not why this happened.
Matt, what have your impressions been of that part of the story?
Yeah, I think the film handles it very well. I mean, if you look at the Janet Cook scandal, which took place in the 1980s at the Washington Post, that was very much more about race. It was about the newspaper, the Washington Post, trying to come to terms with not serving its black readers very well. It was about trying to cover the black community in Washington and just doing a terrible job and letting this terrible fabrication get through that eventually was won a Pulitzer Prize before it was pulled. But it was partly the paper just wasn't very good at figuring out how to do diversity. With the New York Times, this is a totally different case, a totally different situation. I wonder if the Janet Cook legacy has something to do with it, if that's just the frame that people looked at it for. But I also wonder, and this might be a question for Stephanie, is Jason Blair did title his book Burning Down My Master's House, which has very strong racial overtones in the title there. And I'm wondering how that reconciles.
Samantha, I think he was referring to you as Stephanie.
I'm sorry.
Both of us have made that name thing mistake today. But go ahead, Samantha.
No problem. Maybe I should change my name to Stephanie because a number of people seem to make that jump. So, you know, he did title his book Burning Down My Master's House, which is problematic for many, 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 many reasons. And when I asked him about this in the first interview that I did with him, he said that, you know, that was the conclusion that was drawn in the mainstream media and that was sort of the big stick that people carried when they're talking about this story. And that, you know, for him personally, being African American at a primarily white institution and having come into that institution through a minority internship program just sort of sets things up for a bad dynamic. Because from his perspective, what he was saying is that people then assume that you're only there because you got in through this minority internship program. When in fact that may or may not be the case, and that therefore the people who have come in through the minority internship program feel like they are never going to be seen or valued as equal to the people that did not come in through that program. And I think that this is just sort of a dilemma that's inherent in affirmative action, perhaps.
Matt Carlson, how much damage if any, but I assume there was. How much damage was done to the New York Times by all of this?
Well, it's become sort of the single incident used to talk about the dark side of the New York Times. Again, I mentioned Judith Miller earlier, and I think that's a much worse infraction. But yet Jason Blair has become this symbol that still gets used to talk about how the Times has failed. But, you know, I don't think I look at the Times as being any less authoritative after Jason Blair. I think that there was some chaos during the Hal Raines years. And I don't know what the lasting effect is. I think it has more to say about journalism in general than it does for the New York Times. I mean, the New York Times really did redo a lot of its standards. They put in a new standards editor in response to this and the pre-war reporting. And so I think fixed some other issues. They adopted a public editor, which they still have. The current public editor, Margaret Sullivan, is very good and well beyond the issues that first caused this to be put in place. So I think that the more it's the symbol that Jason Blair can still be invoked, and you can say Jason Blair and people feel like, oh, that guy that made up all this stuff at the Times. And I don't think that's going to go away anytime soon.
Samantha, how do you feel about the damage quotient here?
Well, you know, I live in San Francisco now. I'm from New York, and I get the New York Times delivered to my door still. And I believe that this certainly, you know, not only did the New York Times take a big hit because of this, but journalists everywhere took a big hit because of this. I do want to say, though, that I think, you know, in this moment during the digitization of the mainstream media, the democratization of the media, where we've got all these voices in there and, you know, anybody with a blog can put their views out there and publish their views. It's important to remember that while that's great and that's really adding to the conversation, it's never going to replace institutional media. And that institutional media, like the New York Times, is not perfect, but it's very important in terms of being able to take on large organizations like the government, large organizations like corporations. An individual journalist is just going to have a very hard time standing up to those big, powerful organizations. And we need these journalism institutions like the New York Times, even with their flaws, to play that role in this democracy.
I want to play another clip from your film, and this one will be with Howard Kurtz, a media critic then for The Washington Post. He's since gone on to work for other organizations, I think most notably probably CNN. Many people know him and his work, but here's what he had to say about the impact of the Blair case.
The Jason Blair debacle became shorthand for all of the shortcomings of the news business. Because it happened at the New York Times, because there were so many stories involved, because the Times itself aggressively investigated this and ran its findings on the front page, this became an explosion.
Howard Kurtz, who was seen several times in the video that is going to be playing here on Saturday, A Fragile Trust. Matt, let me turn to you. There's another irony here in that Howard Kurtz is making these comments and several comments in the film, and he himself has been victimized by some suggested wrongdoing.
Well, Howard Kurtz did do something really embarrassing, first of all, which is he interviewed who he thought was a congressman and turned out to be a congressional spokesperson and printed it as if it was an interview. It was a mistake, and there was some suggestion that he took a little while to correct that mistake. And then he's had some other sort of issues with his reporting and some suggestions that he wasn't as thorough as he should be, and ended up leaving the Daily Beast, where he went after CNN and Washington Post, and leaving CNN. And I think he gets a lot of flack for being somebody who talks about journalism, but the suggestions that maybe he isn't the best at journalism. So there is definitely some irony there. But he's also been an authoritative voice on journalism for a long time.
Samantha, I was taken somewhat aback when I saw Howard Kurtz in your film.
So Howard Kurtz is in the film because he is the person that broke the story about this plagiarism happening. And I made a decision fairly early on when I was conceiving the film to limit it to first-person accounts of people who were involved somehow. So people who were actually there as things were happening. And the two people who are in the film who were not kind of working inside the Times at that time are Howard Kurtz, who is the journalist who broke the story of the scandal while working at the Washington Post, and then Seth Manoogian, who was a media reporter for Newsweek at the time. And Seth was the first person to publish an article in Newsweek about Jason Blair subsequent to the whole scandal breaking. So both of them really were there on the ground working on the story and the scandal as it was unfolding. And then Seth went on to write a book about it. Mm-hmm. So in terms of including Howard Kurtz, you know, regardless of what came later, he was there at the time and he did break the story about Jason Blair and the plagiarism that was happening at the Times.
I'm going to try to get one more caller in. We'll bring in Elizabeth from St. Louis, but Elizabeth's time is getting away, so it'll have to be quick.
I just wanted to talk about Fox News and Rupert Murdoch, who has bought up so many television stations and newspapers. And, I you know, it's a threat to our democracy. And you also see people like the Koch brothers who have a right-wing agenda, and they are taking over PBS. And I find that very frightening.
Elizabeth, thanks for the call. Do you want to comment on that, Matt?
Yeah, I think that calls attention to just how powerful institutional media remain. As Samantha pointed out earlier, I mean, these are very powerful forces. There's much beyond our view that we don't see, right? And we rely on the news to tell us what's going on outside of our world. And we should care. We should care about who the owners are. We should care about how these practices are. We should care about what newsrooms are doing because we rely on them so much. Even with all the other new voices, which are great, we need to make sure we have a strong media system and we pay attention and we don't let and these infractions go by.
I have a tweet here from Wayne, which I'll read before going back to Samantha. Media varies greatly, and with it, my trust. I always first ask who benefits from the conclusion drawn from the story. Samantha, we only have a little less than a minute left. Do you want to put a bottom line on this? What did you learn from all of this?
Before I do that, I just want to say thanks to Wayne, because that is ultimately the goal, is to have people caring about the media and thinking about the media in a critical way, because the number of voices are only going to increase, and it's really important that people take an active role in consuming media. And I would say, you know, on the heels of that statement, that's sort of one of the conclusions that I did draw from this, is that, you know, it's really important to be careful as you're doing your work as a journalist, and also as you're doing your work as a reader and a consumer of the media, that you should ask questions. You should take an active role. You should, you know, think about who's writing it and what is their motivation. And if you do those things, you can have a more interactive and involved relationship with the news.
That's where media literacy comes in. We've done a number of programs on that. Samantha Grant, thanks so much for being with us. She's the producer-director of A Fragile Trust, which will be shown this Saturday at 1:30 at the Plaza Frontenac Cinema. Look forward to seeing you then, Samantha. Thank you for being with us. And Matt Carlson, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll ask you to join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk with two St. Louis area natives about the screening of their films at the St. Louis International Film Festival. He'll check in with Adam Crane for an update about the St. Louis Symphony's performance at Carnegie Hall tomorrow night. And he'll talk about cooking Thanksgiving dinner in a monthly soundbite segment in partnership with Sauce Magazine. Do you have a question about cooking Thanksgiving dinner, or what is your best piece of advice? Send us an email, talk@stlpublicradio.org. Monday on St. Louis On the Air, we'll talk about current issues pertaining to the law with our legal roundtable panelists. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. Our thanks to producers Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, production assistants from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Jeremy Bailey, Kristen Torres, and Spencer Reed. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.